The way schools are funded in Illinois has been getting a lot of attention lately, with a proposal at the state capitol to refigure how the state education money is given out. I'm Bill Wheelhouse. The WUIS Education Desk is committed to giving a better understanding of the school funding issue. This broadcast is from a recent community event in Decatur sponsored by the Education Coalition of Macon County. WSOY Radio's Brian Byers and I ask questions of a panel that includes State Senator Andy Menar, a Democrat from Macoupin County, Ralph Martiri, Executive Director of the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability, Kristen Kendrick, Superintendent of the Warrensburg-Latham School District, and Todd Kovalt, Director of Business Affairs for the Decatur Public Schools. We begin with Senator Menar discussing the education legislation.
It's very difficult, I'm going to admit, to give you a synopsis of Senate Bill 16, for no other reason than it's a sizable piece of legislation. It's a complicated piece of legislation, but it's also an appropriate piece of legislation, in my opinion. But I want to begin with a story to give you a little bit of my own history, to tell you how long we've been struggling with this issue in Illinois. Back in 1997, I was an intern for who was a titan in the state Senate for downstate, a gentleman by the name of Vince DiMuzio. I was an unpaid intern for him. You had to work for Vince for a year before you were actually hired by him. And in 1997, I was asked if I wanted to attend a joint session of the General Assembly by his side. And at the time, Governor Edgar was struggling to convince the General Assembly that the steps that we are trying to take in Senate Bill 16 should be achieved back then, 17 years ago. So one of my first visits to the state capitol was to hear the governor's address between the House and the Senate, demanding that Illinois take steps to bring equity to public schools, which at the time was sizable in terms of its inequity. Compared to today, it was minimal in 1997. So my experience goes all the way back to when Governor Edgar pushed the General Assembly in 1997 to take the steps that we are taking today. Those things were done in 1997, but not to the extent that he had asked for. And we are still reeling through that today. And over the course of 17 years, the inequity has gotten much worse, not much better. So Senate Bill 16 began through the course of a very simple action in the state Senate about this time last year. We passed a measure that put a time frame on ourselves as legislators to produce a product, not just complain about an issue, but produce an actual viable piece of legislation that could be voted on, that was logical, that took into account various opinions and diverse opinions across the state, to do one thing, set us on a different course than the one we're on today. And I'm going to fast forward about 12 months because we'll get into these details through the course of the event tonight. But today we do have that piece of legislation before us. It is far from perfect, but it is a sizable and appropriate change for what we face today in the state. At its core, and the premise that we enter this equation from, is that of all the money we spend in the state budget, and this is not a budgetary conversation at the moment. We have to have it, but not at the moment. Senate Bill 16 doesn't spend a single penny more than we spend today. But at its core, Senate Bill 16 says that the money that we appropriate in the state budget should attach need as a criteria for how it's distributed. Because today in Illinois, only about 42% of that appropriation uses need as a determination for how it gets from the state budget to the 860-plus school districts in the state. And we are an anomaly in the nation when it comes to that, which would explain the sizable inequities within our system. So the first thing Senate Bill 16 does is it doesn't say go spend more. It says we should attach need as a criteria for how we distribute more money in the state budget. That would bring us in line to not just our peer states, but literally every other state in the country. That's one very, very profound change in Senate Bill 16. Number two, we all know, and you know, just take a look at your neighborhood, take a look at Decatur, take a look at Macoupin County, take a look at any part of the state. We all know that the state has changed dramatically in 17 years. But what hasn't changed in 17 years is the school funding formula. So we aren't recognizing where the needs are today through the course of how our law exercises how money is distributed. So we're still moving money from the state budget to school districts based on a set of needs that were the case in 1997 when Governor Edgar called the General Assembly together to give his speech. And that, of course, is very different than today. So we have to account for the needs of today's Illinois, and that's the second thing that Senate Bill 16 does. What are those needs? We have poverty that is, I call it a proliferation of poverty, unfortunately, in the state. There are many more school districts, especially downstate rural districts, that are grappling with the challenges that come with poverty and when children live in poverty and they go to school every day. We have many more bilingual learners in Illinois. One out of every four children in public schools in Illinois comes from a bilingual household. That's news to a lot of people's ears, but that's a fact, and we have to account for that in our school funding formula. That number was much lower in 1997. But the biggest change is that the wealth of property in Illinois has become highly concentrated in very specific parts of the state. And I want to tread lightly here, because this part of the conversation isn't about punishing one part of the state or rewarding another, but it surely has to happen because we have to account for that disparity in property wealth to a better degree than we do today in the school funding formula. That's how you achieve greater equity. Those three things alone will bring us eons forward in terms of what we face today and the path we're on versus the alternative path, which is Senate Bill 16. There are many other facets to the bill, by the way. We'll get into those this evening, but at its core, those are three things that have been worked on for years and years and years. What we've tried to do is to build a coalition day by day to get this bill passed and sent to the governor and hopefully enacted. We have to, at the same time, have an adequacy discussion. How much is enough for public schools? That's a discussion we haven't had in a long time. But pumping more money into the current system is not going to solve the problems of Decatur. It's not going to solve the problems of the districts that face the most challenges. So we have to first change the methodology, and then we have to decide how much we want to put into it. Those two things will get us where we need to go. Senate Bill 16 is a small, believe it or not, small but important piece of that. So again, thank you. That was a very brief introduction. I'd be happy to discuss more details with questions, and I look forward to the discussion with the panelists. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Opening up the questions, and some of these will be directed to the Senator. Others, feel free to amplify, echo, or contradict. One question that was submitted regarding this proposal, are there any restrictions as to how the funding must be spent under this proposed legislation?
There are, that's a sizable change from current law. So what Senate Bill 16 seeks to accomplish, in addition to better aligning resources with where our challenges are today in public education, we also, for example, require that if we as a state are going to say that districts with a high poverty rate, with a high at-risk student population, receive additional funds so that we can achieve the same outcomes between districts that have high poverty and districts that don't, we want to make sure that those funds get to where those students actually go to school. So not only do we have disparity within or between districts in the state, we have disparity within districts sometimes too. So we seek to better address issues when it comes to the characteristics of the students that are being served in public schools. And that's a new thing for the state. But again, I think it's an appropriate discussion to have, because if we're going to say we are going to weight or value within our funding formula districts that have high poverty rates, we have to make sure that that money gets to where the students that live in poverty actually attend class.
Senator, will SB 16 increase overall school funding? And if so, where will the state get the additional dollars?
The answer is no. Senate Bill 16 is strictly a discussion about law. The school code governs how money comes from the budget and is distributed to school districts. So the discussion we've had thus far in the Senate and to a lesser degree in the House are very disciplined in the sense that whether we spend, you know, $6 billion on schools or whether we spend $1 billion or whether we spend $100 million, how we distribute it matters. So Senate Bill 16 doesn't call for additional spending, but it does call for better spending in my mind. As I mentioned earlier, and I know Ralph is chomping at the bit to jump in on this one. As I mentioned earlier, we should have the discussion about adequacy. But before we can get there, in my opinion, we have to have a very honest and frank and difficult discussion about equity. As I said earlier, we could pump $1 billion into the system if it were there, and it wouldn't fix the problems that we face in the state today. We have to have a better distribution formula, which I think would then call upon the larger discussion about how much is enough for public education.
I'm Ralph Martiri, Executive Director of the Bipartisan Center for Tax and Budget Accountability. Then that means my board of directors neither likes nor trusts each other very much. And that's a good thing for us at staff because it allows us to focus on best practices, evidence, and data. So the reality is very much as Senator Menar laid it out on the implications of the changes being made by this bill. It does not increase school funding overall. It does redistribute school funding within the existing matrix. So while my organization completely agrees with this redistribution and a greater focus on equity, in fact, the work I did on the Federal Commission was focused on equity and excellence combined together, our word of caution, even with this redistribution and as positive as it is from an equity standpoint, you will not see better results. You will not see better academic outcomes. And the reason for that is the system doesn't have adequate resources on the front end to generate the student outcomes on the back end we all desire. And I think one of the reasons Governor Edgar, in fact, I know one of the reasons Governor Edgar was looking into educational equity back then, he was also looking into adequacy because they were concerned about results. And one thing Governor Edgar noted, and in fact, you know who the first noted it was? Richard Nixon in the 1972 Nixon Commission. Is one of the core problems with education funding at virtually every state level is that it's completely divorced from the cost of educating children. So a number is determined through a legislative process that's based on what the state perceives it can afford, not what it costs to educate kids. That disconnect exists in what other endeavor in the private sector? If you ran a business and you didn't know what it costs to produce your services or your products, you'd be out of business in a quick hurry. And so to really see enhanced student performance in Illinois, we absolutely have to deal with the adequacy issue. And the good news is we can, because unlike a lot of other public policy areas, education has sufficient data for us to take an evidence-based approach. Evidence-based meaning looking at those pedagogical, instructional capacity issues about education that actually have a statistically meaningful correlation to improving student achievement over time. Look at what those practices are and cost them out for our state and come up with a number. And in fact, my organization working with a PhD has done that. And basically, it would cost about $5 billion more in public education funding today than what's being invested in Illinois to do a much better job of educating our children across the state and seeing better outcomes. And so I will do a little bit of tax talk and then let it go on. You know, that would require a tax increase. We couldn't get there from our current revenue streams, even if this temporary tax increase is made permanent. But $5 billion, while it sounds like a lot of money, is less than 1% of our state's economy. We have a $696 billion state GDP. We are letting a tax increase of less than 1% of our economic activity stand in the way of creating an educational system that actually has the resources needed to educate our kids. I find that questionable.
Todd Koval, Decatur Schools. I'd like to first of all say that the Decatur School District is highly supportive of this bill. You know, anything that the state can do to better equalize the system is going to be very favorable to the Decatur schools. The premise of the question was, will overall funding increase? And I'd like to at least clarify what's happened over the last two or three years with school funding. As assessed values have diminished, at the local level, school districts have lost significant funds. What that has done is it's put a great amount of pressure on the state to then offset that loss at the local level, and the state doesn't have funds to basically offset that. So although the question was, will it have an increase in funding, I wanted to clarify that overall school districts have lost funds the last 2-3 years.
Yeah, from the state as well. I mean, not just from local resources. So education funding has been cut even in nominal dollars over the last few years. In fact, according to ISBE, I pulled this data just for today. Right now, the most recent data, 532 of our 860 school districts are deficit spending. That's 62%. 8 years ago, only 32% of our school districts were deficit spending. That is significant. When you have two-thirds of your school districts deficit spending, that's simply not a sustainable system. And you really have to find a way to get adequate, sustainable resources into it, especially if, and we have every right as voters and taxpayers to demand this, but especially if we're going to demand accountable outcomes from the system. I mean, one thing that's been historically missing from accountability, and one thing my organization would like to see modified in this legislation, frankly, is that the accountability matrix include a resource accountability aspect. We want to know if schools actually have the capacity on the front end to reach the outcomes we want at the school level. And the answer is going to be no in the vast majority of cases. I'm fortunate enough to serve on a school board in River Forest District 90 where we have adequate resources and National Blue Ribbon School and blah, blah. We would lose funding. We've run tentative numbers. We would lose funding from the state under this bill and yet support it because it's the right way to distribute resources. And it's a positive step forward for Illinois.
Dr. Cavall, could I follow up then? And maybe you could let people know specifically to District 61, has or will, with budget cuts, if there's no new changes in legislation, what will it mean for the future of District 61?
Well, again, the driver is the assessed value. The state has a formula. There's actually 10 formulas for funding schools, which this bill does a lot towards clarifying that into one formula instead of having 10. But for Decatur schools, the overall assessed value for Decatur has dropped about 3.5% this past year. And again, based upon the way allocations are currently funded to schools, we would have to get an additional 3.5% from the state to basically stay even. Right now, if you look at the comptroller's website, right now the comptroller has $2 billion outstanding bills. I don't think the state has funds to provide additional funding in schools. We were funded at 89% of our general state aid this year. It was prorated. An indication of when they calculated all of what they needed to pay schools, they didn't have enough, so they had to prorate down the general state aid statewide. I talked to the chief financial officer for the Illinois State Board of Education. His projections, and he's usually right on target, are 83.5% under the current system. So we would expect a 3.5% loss at local revenues based upon the loss of tax collections. We would anticipate going from an 89% proration to an 83.5% proration at the state level. We're looking at possibly millions of dollars lost. As Ralph stated, we're one of those districts. We're spending down our reserves. We're anticipating probably a little over $3 million this year alone.
Kristen, I'd like to hear your take on some of those things as they apply to your school district.
Sure. I, too, am in support of the bill. For Warrensburg-Latham, if the bill is passed, we would be gaining an additional $300,000. And just like Dr. Colvault said, with the amount prorated each year, I'm going to call it what I think it is. It's our funding's cut. It's not proration is a nice way to word it. Our funding's cut based on what's in legislation of what we are supposed to receive for each individual pupil. And so over the last 3 to 4 years for Warrensburg, which is a smaller district, that's a compounded loss of $1.4 million. We have cut just as many of our neighboring districts as much as we can cut without truly impacting the integrity of our students' education. And so I would agree that, you know, we're in desperate need for a change to occur, and look forward to hearing more about the amendments coming with this bill.
Martin, you mentioned that some districts will be hurt financially. They will lose money under this. Yet taking a bigger picture and looking at the state as a whole, and maybe, Senator, you could address this too, to the folks out there, no one wants to lose $100,000 or $200,000 or $300,000 of the funding, even if they're doing better than a neighboring school district. How do you speak to that?
So this is a question that comes up often because we don't face a budget scenario that's flush with cash. I mean, let's be honest. It's a difficult circumstance that we face in Springfield today. It's probably not going to get too much better in the near future. But a couple of things. I've met with or talked to over 320 superintendents, I think, at this point in the state about the bill. I asked for criticism about the bill. Much of it comes in the way of, you know, what am I supposed to do if my district loses money? What I remind them is a system that props up and supports a small number of school districts that are premier in the state or blue ribbon in the state that produce everything we ask them to do and beyond. And we have the same situation where others falter behind, and we put those two things together, and we can't call that as a win as a state. We can't say that we can only support a few to the extent that they meet expectations as taxpayers, as parents, as citizens of the state. So, number one, if everybody's not on a good course, we're all losing as a state. Number two, there's value to stability for school districts. There's no stability today. It's a very unstable, unpredictable environment for school boards and for superintendents. So Senate Bill 16 will bring about a new level of stability. Number three, it's a very simple method compared to the current method. It is complicated, but compared to the current method of distribution, it's quite simple. So those things, I think, all have value to every school district in the state, whether they win or they lose under the bill. But the biggest, I think, outcome is that if we can find a formula that school districts and administrators and school boards believe in the state, we can have a very different conversation about the state budget. It's very difficult to advocate for money in a tough budget environment in a form and fashion that it would go to a formula that doesn't work, meaning that it doesn't get to the places that need it the most. So it's hard to go advocate for money anyway. Number two, it's hard to go advocate for money for a formula that is completely broken. So if we have a formula that works, and by the way, no one's defending the current formula in the state. I've yet to find a good defense for it in the past 12 months. I'm waiting. So if nobody's defending it, then that means we should change it. And if we can change it, then we can have the discussion about how much money do we put into it. And that would be a discussion that I believe every district in the state would welcome, whether they have tremendous resources or whether they don't.
Yeah, and I think it's unfortunate that these printout politics are always utilized to stand in the way of well-thought-out, well-intentioned, and well-designed approaches to reform, which overall this is. And I have to tell you, it follows a number of best practices we identified at the federal level. So it eliminated a bunch of individual categorical approaches to funding education, and it wrapped them all in a formula using weights. That's a best practice. That's what you're supposed to do. It recognizes that the distribution of your resources should be equitable with the appropriate definition of equitable. When it comes to education funding, equitable doesn't mean equal. I mean, one of the real problems you have with equity in education funding is you cannot treat dissimilar populations the same way. And for the most part, our education funding system was treating dissimilar populations the same way. Well, that's a prescription for disaster. In fact, what we know, when you compare America to every other OECD nation on performance on these international tests, the PISA exams, overall we're Midland as a country. We're right in the middle, a lot of OECD nations ahead of us and a lot below us. But when you differentiate by poverty, those school districts in America with 0 to 10% poverty score highest in the world on the PISA exams, higher than any other nation, higher than Finland, which we all hold out as the example. Then you go to that next cut on poverty, which is roughly 10 to 24% poverty. Fourth highest in the world, and highest in the world when compared to other nations that have a similar poverty profile in their demographics. America's scores don't start to decline until poverty gets to 25% and above. 48% of the school children in Illinois who attend public schools come from poverty. 48%. And we are not equitably directing resources to these children to give them a meaningful educational opportunity so they have the chance to learn and succeed. Well, of course we're not going to get the outcomes we want. So you do have to fix this formula, and fixing it in a way that focuses on equity is a path to excellence. It is a path to getting better results. But if your overall funding is inadequate at the front end, and this is our caution, we testified in favor of the legislation, but our caution is no one should think that after we have a more equitable distribution of resources, outcomes will improve. They will not. The system does not have enough capacity on the front end to get those outcomes we want on the back end. So this is an important, as you said, piece of moving forward, but it will not accomplish the ultimate goal of getting better student outcomes and more meaningful educational opportunities across Illinois until we make the greater investment in that the data tell us we need to make.
Combining a couple of questions that I've seen here, while we indicate downstate overall fares better, there are certainly instances that have been pointed out today of downstate school districts that would take a hit if no additional funding was added. In addition, there is the possible impact on the Chicago area schools. Is there enough statewide legislative support to pass this bill? Whether it be downstate support or Chicago support, how are you going to get it passed in the Senate, let alone before it crosses the aisle to the Illinois House?
There's no good answer for this question. And I think you've noticed I admit when I don't have an answer. So what I do know is that there's always a reason not to do this. And I think if Governor Edgar were here, he would say that this is a difficult – he told me this last summer. He said this is going to be tough. And just look to the proof that it hasn't happened in 17 years as the proof of how hard this is going to be. But I always remind my colleagues in the Senate, and I walked in the door a year ago, but I remind my colleagues in the Senate that we can always come up with a reason not to do this. There's an election. We got a tough budget. It's complicated. Maybe you're not going to get it the whole way there. But what we have done is we forced the conversation on Springfield. We have forced people to talk about this issue for the first time in a very, very long time. I think that type of forcing of a conversation will lead to a positive outcome. Is the bill going to look exactly like it looks today? Probably not. Is it going to change? It probably is going to change. It has changed significantly since it was introduced a month ago due to the constructive criticism of people all over the state. Every meeting I've had with superintendents, there has been an idea shared that has been incorporated into this bill. That's how you make a better product, and ultimately, I believe that's how you get a bill passed.
You know, when you look at Chicago all by itself, you know, one of the things about costing this out is that you always have to look at prior year data. And if you look at Chicago in terms of how much they're probably going to receive if the state is funding at the 83.5% level, they're going to probably lose close to $58 million just on the proration under the current system. And I'm sure that the Chicago people are very intelligent and will be paying attention to that, because when you compare that to what they may gain or lose out of this system, the current system is probably not going to be favorable to them either. You made a comment about downstate. You know, I've read in some newspapers they're calling this bill the downstate bill. It's not a downstate bill. It is about where property values lie. In my prior life, I served as the financial officer for Prairie Hills, which is Markham, Hazelcrest, Oak Forest, Country Club Hills. And I looked at the price out on them. They'll gain under this formula. They're a Cook County school district. I also used to work in the Crete-Moniz school district, which is Will County. And they also gain under this. And it's primarily because they don't have the commercial, which raises your tax values, that where you gain the most tax value.
Senator, or anyone on the panel, a couple of questions coming through social media this evening. One of these, a very old question, but it comes up a lot whenever anyone talks about education reform, is the promise of the lottery system and how that was going to be used to fund education. At the risk of don't shoot the messenger, I'm passing this question along. Is there any chance that that could be looked at again as education funding, or is that forever lost?
Let me clarify this. So the tax geek will take this question. All 98% of the lottery proceeds have always gone to the Common School Fund and funded education. 98%. 2% are used for like cancer research and a couple of really small things, but 98% has gone to education. But because every year, after adjusting for inflation and population growth, the rate of growth and the cost of maintaining the current level of services from year one to year two grows faster than our revenues grow. And every year our debt service, paying for past sins, grows. You see a gap between revenue growth and what it costs to just maintain providing the same level of services you did the prior year and meet your debt service obligations. So when the new money from the lottery came into schools, other money from that used to go into schools came out, dollar for dollar. So the lottery became replacement revenue rather than enhancement revenue. Now, of course, there are ways to design around that going forward if you want to ensure that you're actually growing education funding. Some of that was put into bills submitted HB 750. An old bill had a methodology for ensuring that. But the bottom line is the only reason that shell game was played with the lottery money is because the state's fiscal resources are inadequate to maintain current services. So when a new revenue source was discovered, it just replaced old revenue.
Another question that I've had several times this evening, asking whether SB 16 or whatever it looks like at the end will have any impact on local property taxes or local control.
It's difficult to say. Local property taxes, of course, are a decision of locally elected school boards. But we've talked a lot about property taxes this evening, and I just want to use this example that I think illustrates my earlier point that the system is designed to fail in its current form. We had a hearing in our second Education Funding Advisory Committee, or EFAC. We had our second hearing in Springfield, and there was a nonpartisan group that came in and did kind of an overall picture of what we do in Illinois and critiqued us. We asked them for a critique from an outside viewpoint, and it was a stinging indictment of our current system. It confirmed everything that we knew was wrong with the state, and it outlined in great detail the depth of the challenge that we faced. And this was in September of last year. But there was a line in that report that said that the state system of funding schools in Illinois is neither fair to students or taxpayers. And that's an important point because that, to my knowledge, was the first time that I've heard the word taxpayers being injected into this conversation. So I think this is what they meant. And I didn't write the report, but I'm gonna go out on a limb here a little bit. And I think this is what they meant. Oftentimes we gravitate our minds toward tax bills. You know, what's the amount in a tax bill? But when it comes to the state aid formula, we concentrate on a rate. And we measure ability to pay more on the rate of taxes rather than the assessed value because that's determined locally. But the rate of taxes is what triggers how much money can be put into the system from the local level. So I'm going to give you one. I'm going to try to do this. This is hard. I wish I had a whiteboard behind me. But I'm going to give you one example, the most extreme example that I could come up with. In East St. Louis, the tax rate is $7.40-some-odd cents, and the poverty rate is 99%. And with that tax rate of $7.45 or $7.42, about $1,200 per student is generated. So $7.45 generates $1,200 per student. In Arlington Heights, the tax rate is $1.30, somewhere around there. The poverty rate is a fraction of East St. Louis. And with that $1.30 tax rate, $18,000 is generated per student. So that isn't fair to students or taxpayers. In plain terms, that means that East St. Louis, even if they wanted to tax themselves at a much higher rate, they couldn't even do it to bring about equity on their own. So the tax burden in East St. Louis is incredibly high, but the values are very low. And again, I mentioned this earlier, this isn't pitting East St. Louis and Arlington Heights against each other. It's recognizing that this is a fact. This is the system that we have today. And in my mind, the purpose of state aid is to account for that tremendous disparity, that a tax rate that's a fraction of the other can generate 10 times as much money locally. That's wonderful. That's wonderful for Arlington Heights. And they have tremendous schools in Arlington Heights, and they should be proud of it, and our state should be proud of it. But what we have to do is a very difficult thing, and that's have a conversation about how to account for that. So property taxes are a big piece. And oftentimes taxpayers and tax rates aren't injected into the conversation at the legislative level. I'll admit that. But we're trying to have those conversations, not to say that one's better or worse, but to say we have to account for that so that we can have a healthy state system that produces good graduates everywhere.
To emphasize what Andy just said and give you numbers, from the middle 90s to 2005, after you adjust for inflation, so you have property taxes growing at a rate that outstrips the rate of growth in income for most earners by close to 20 times. That's not sustainable, and it's not fair to taxpayers. You want to factor in the Great Recession. Of course, now median income has declined by 9.2% since the Great Recession after inflation. Property taxes have grown by almost 10. So you have this tax that is way over relied on in Illinois, primarily to fund schools, that you can't take the burden off of. You can't get to reducing property taxes in a meaningful way until the state does a better job of funding schools from state-based resources. This is an argument that we've been making for a very long time, and it's not just a difficult tax for people to pay. When you dissect business taxes in Illinois, the corporate income tax is 8% of all taxes businesses pay in Illinois. The individual income tax on the flow-through earnings of S-corporations, limited partnerships, that tax, only 4.7% of all business taxes paid in Illinois. Property tax, 40% of all business taxes paid in Illinois. You want to do something that reduces tax burden in a fair way for businesses and people. You want to raise money at the state level through your income and sales tax and invest it in adequately funding schools and take the burden off the property tax.
To get further clarification on this, so as we've talked about the more equitable distribution of general state aid funds, and then we've talked about the higher per pupil spending in the suburban districts, the question from this person is, will this address that per pupil spending that comes from the property tax in poorer districts and wealthier districts?
It will get additional resources into communities that have significant concentrations of low-income populations. So it will take some of the pressure off of the property tax in a lower-income community, but not enough to make a difference because of the adequacy issue. But it certainly, if we had an adequate starting point, this would take tremendous, tremendous pressure off the property tax, especially, and not just in low-income communities. You'd go to middle-income and even upper-middle-income communities where it would take pressure off. So the formula itself can't work that specific magic just because there's not adequate resources coming in on the front end from the state. But our current school funding formula, it wouldn't make much of a difference even if more resources came in, I think, which is one of the reasons why Senator Menar and his colleagues went down this path.
Does this bill replicate any policies from states with more equitable funding in education and states that have better student outcomes than Illinois?
Nearly the entire bill. Our process was extensive. We had 7 public hearings, 45 hours of public testimony. But at the root of Senate Bill 16 is what I would call best practices from other states. We asked a facilitator from a group called the Education Commission of the States to find practices that have worked and help us avoid practices that haven't worked in other states. And I would describe the bill as a set of those practices that have proven to work. And I would point to Massachusetts as one state that much of the bill is modeled after.
Why in the new formula is early education still considered separately?
That was an outgrowth of many things, most of which from superintendents in the state that said that early education investment is a separate conversation than an equity conversation. So there are very few programs. Todd mentioned that there's many distribution formulas today for the different programs. There's very few that we exclude in Senate Bill 16, one of which is early childhood. We have capacity issues we have to deal with in early childhood education in the state. Early childhood education dollars are not distributed for good reason with the basis of equity as the driving factor. It's a much different scenario. So early childhood, because I would say educators and practitioners who do this every day said leave that alone. It's a totally separate program that should be separated out from the bill.
One of the complications you have in Illinois as well is that you have unit districts, which is like Decatur. We have K through 12. You have high school districts, and you have elementary districts. If you're going to fund in a common methodology, it's very difficult to affect a high school district that obviously would not have an early childhood program.
In addition to general state aid funds, a member of the audience asked, what other funds will be wrapped into this new state funding system, for example, transportation, special education, et cetera?
It would be nearly everything except for early childhood, as we mentioned, high-cost special education, and special ed transportation. Those programs behave very differently than anything else in the State Board of Education's budget. Those exclusions came at the suggestion, again, of educators. And are consistent with other states. Everything else, that's the easier way to say it, Brian, everything else is rolled into a single formula. And let me say why that's valuable. When there's one formula, the competition for where money goes in the state budget is gone. It's gone. The idea that you can slice and dice the state into geography and wherever the numbers are in terms of votes, that's where the money is plopped on the table. That's what we do now. We don't drive it, as Ralph said, where the most results can come from. We don't drive it as the basis of how much is needed. We drive the money today where the most votes come from. And so when we have one funding formula, there's only one place to put it. And that means everybody benefits equally. So that's something that we need to talk about more, not because we live in downstate, but because that serves the entire state well. It supports a state system, not separate systems within a state.
This question from the audience is regarding poverty, high poverty schools. It says, has increased funding in high poverty schools been demonstrated to impact academic outcomes?
Yes, it definitely has. Maryland and Massachusetts are two cases that have really done a phenomenal job educating their poor children to higher academic outcomes than other states, and they invest the most in their low-income populations. And interestingly, the OECD nations we compete with, I've mentioned Finland a couple of times. Finland went from being midland to below midland to number one in the world in overall results, specifically by focusing on investing the resources needed first in their low-income schools and then getting up the ladder. They viewed equity as a path to excellence. And in fact, every OECD nation that did that saw their student performance improve. And nations like the U.S., Canada, New Zealand, Australia, Great Britain, Japan, I'm forgetting a couple of others, that have adopted a more competitive model of public education have seen their scores go down on the PISA exams over the last decade. So this has been tested a long time. It's been tested internationally. Now, my organization actually brought Pasi Salberg to Chicago. He's the director of education for Finland. And his first joke was, if you want to realize the American dream, move to Finland. Because what we did was we took all your information and all your data and what your evidence says are best practices, and we implemented it. You guys just need the political will to implement it. So I thought that was a pretty sobering comment to make.
Another question from the audience. Regarding the additional weights with the proposed funding change, will the career pathway and dual credit weights only take into consideration current pathway programs, or will there be new requirements and programs to adopt?
That's a good segue from the last question, actually. It's no coincidence that communities with the highest unemployment have oftentimes the highest poverty. That's not a coincidence. And this portion of the bill hasn't been talked about at all, by the way, so I appreciate whoever asked the question for putting this one in. We would be a leading state to value in our funding formula these types of courses. Dual credit courses are good because it saves people money when they go to college. Mm-hmm. Career pathway courses are good because you have a conversation between employers and the public school district, so you match skills so when graduates walk out the door, they have the skills to take jobs. So we are waiting, or I guess a better way to say it would be valuing in our formula what I think is good behavior on the part of school districts. Why do we have to do that today? Because in my mind, every school district should have dual credit courses for high school students. Every school district should have STEM courses, career pathway courses, courses that drive students to achievement, give them skills so that they are employable. That takes more money. But on the back end of that equation is a whole lot of savings when you talk about what does poverty cost and what does unemployment cost in Illinois. This is a very, very good thing for Illinois. This is an issue about competitiveness, making sure we can out-educate competitors. That's an important part of the equation that we don't talk about often enough in Illinois, that we have to be competitive not just with peer states but with the world. And this piece is a small piece but an important piece of the bill. Okay. And Brian, I want to mention one thing because this is specific to Decatur. There's been, and I think Decatur public schools do a good job with these courses, but I know the Jobs for America's Graduates program is one of these programs that I was thinking about when this piece of the bill was drafted. And, specific to what qualifies and what doesn't, I'm of the belief that if it works and if it produces the outcomes that we want, then it deserves that additional money in the state budget. And we should celebrate those things and we should prop them up. And in this case, we should reward those programs with additional money so that they stay and expand and enroll as many students as possible.
Here is a question addressed for Senator Menar. I'm sure it's one you've heard before. Since we have begun to talk about funding, the question says, can you help us with unfunded mandates?
Yeah, this is a tricky one. It's a tricky one for legislators. It's also a tricky one for organizations that represent school boards and administrators. This is something that I believe we can tackle in this bill. We had this conversation first in December. I think it was right after Ralph wrapped up his testimony at the Proviso Math and Science Academy. That we had a conversation about what is the effect of unfunded mandates. And we should recognize that an unfunded mandate to one is an incredibly necessary program to another. But regardless, I think the time has come to take a limited step to give school districts an option to prove that an unfunded mandate would better address inequities in the state. So this is one outstanding piece that I hope to add to the bill. We've worked with administrators to do this, to try to define this to where it can be done. This is a very hard thing to do in Springfield, but we haven't shied away from the difficult conversations yet, so we're going to keep this one going, and it's my hope that we can incorporate something like this into the bill.
I'd like for you guys to use the last minutes to maybe touch on something you were not asked or something you feel passionate about. We'll start with Dr. Cavall.
The one thing I think that we maybe touched on loosely, but I'd like to at least solidify it a little bit more, but the economy of how schools are funded. If you are in the East St. Louis, like was mentioned earlier, and you have to tax, if you have to have an incredible tax rate to fund your school, that's not going to be healthy for a recruiting any type of business to come to your community to establish. A business is going to look and evaluate some places that their tax rates are going to be lower. The unfortunate reality of how schools are funded currently is that you have school systems. You have a school system in the state of Illinois that has the ability to raise 8 times the foundation level. Decatur is about 55% of the foundation. So they would have to have a very, very small tax rate to be able to accomplish what they want to do in the school district. And with a lower tax rate, that's more favorable for businesses to reside in that location. So anything that can be accomplished towards generating more equity, I don't see anything in the bill that's trying to average this by bringing down the school districts that have the wealth at the top. But this bill is more about trying to bring those up closer to that level.
Thank you, Dr. Todd Kvaal, Director of Business Affairs for Decatur Public Schools. Warrensburg-Latham Superintendent Kristen Kendrick.
Sure, I would just like to echo that the current system is not equitable across the state. One piece of this legislation that makes me excited is maybe as a school superintendent, I can actually know what my school district will be receiving the next year in a timely manner when the district and the board has to make decisions about are we keeping programs, teachers, et cetera. Currently, truly, it's a guessing game. We're all making estimates as far as what are we going to receive versus what we should be receiving, and often that timeline does not match up when you have to make decisions legally for the staff that you'll employ. As far as the bipartisan support, I think it's amazing that this bill has gotten as far as it has. I think that speaks volumes. This is definitely an important conversation, and as Senator Menar said, it's only the first step in an important ongoing conversation that we need to continue to have with funding of education, unfunded mandates, and I appreciate you asking school boards, school superintendents, principals to give feedback on what are those unfunded mandates that maybe aren't relevant in our area, and let our community, our board, choose is that important to us or not, and bring back more local control.
The Executive Director of the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability, Ralph Martiri.
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank you for inviting me here. If you think about my job, I do tax policy for a living. I'm pretty happy to be invited anywhere, actually. and I do want to thank Senator Menar, not just for demonstrating leadership on this, but taking best practice seriously. And he's undersold his attempt to make this a bipartisan bill. My organization is bipartisan by its design, and I have to say Senator Menar has gone to efforts to work with both sides of the aisle and, frankly, people who have very different ideological worldviews than him and his own party to try to make a bill that was a consensus bill that could generate support across a broad ideological spectrum. And for that, you really should be congratulated. That's a hard lift. I think big picture, if you look at all the important correlations between education and economic viability, it's amazing that a state like Illinois still gets this wrong. I mean, now the data are compelling. Your educational attainment is directly correlated to your unemployment rate. The higher your level of education, the lower your unemployment rate, vice versa. Since 1980, the only cohort of workers in America that have seen their incomes increase at a rate greater than inflation, a true growth in purchasing power, have a college degree. You can't just graduate high school anymore and get the kind of good job that puts a car or two in the garage and a kid or two through college. You need to have developed such numeracy and literacy skills through your K-12 that you go on and credential yourself further. All the data, all of it, whether the research was done by my organization, the Congressional Budget Office, the Anti-Tax Cato Institute, the Pro-Business Kauffman Foundation, all the research shows there's absolutely no correlation between a state's tax policy and its economic growth. High tax, low tax, irrelevant. You know what there is a statistically meaningful correlation with? Your investment in education and your economic growth. Those states in America over the last 30 years that have done the best job in investing in the education of the children have grown jobs, median wage, and state GDP per capita at a faster rate than their share of the national GDP would suggest and the rest of the nation. We got to learn from the data. This is not an ideological proposition. The evidence is compelling. Now we just need the political will to make it happen.
Senator Andy Menar.
I'm going to close as first a parent and then a legislator. And sometimes, by the way, those two things are very separate, and sometimes they're one and the same. My children, two of my three children, go to school. They have phenomenal teachers. Our school district is a small rural district in Bunker Hill. The school board has made good decisions. The administration has made good decisions. But we have kids that are packed into a school building that was intended for half the number that are there. My kids are lucky to have art every once in a while. And when they do, they go into a room that has no windows that was intended for a janitor's closet. Other students go to speech therapy classes and specialized classes in the library that was converted with 2x4s holding up panels to be a classroom. That's a classroom. I don't use the example of Bunker Hill because it's any more or less profound than things that are happening all over the state. We have kids that open up books every day that are 10 years older than they are, teaching science, that are older than the hands that open them. That's a problem. That's what we value today. That's the best we can do. That's the question we should ask ourselves. That's where you get the will to pass a bill like this. But it is only part of what needs to happen in Illinois. And as a parent, that infuriates me, that the best we can do as a state is have children going to an art class in a janitor's closet. But again, we're lucky that we have art, so we don't complain too much. So we can do better. That's where you get the will to pass a bill like this. As a legislator, in Illinois, it's very easy to run around and complain about things. There's a whole lot of problems that we face. They're sizable and they're deep, but complaining isn't going to change anything. Press conferences don't change the law. You know, standing up and saying that, you know, one part of the state is to blame about the problems that we face, you know, that happens on the other end of the equation as well. That doesn't change anything. It doesn't get teachers rehired. It doesn't fix failing schools. It doesn't buy new books. It doesn't produce a better outcome. So what I've tried to do, and what I would hope that you do as well as citizens and taxpayers of the state, whether you're a teacher or a parent or whatever you're here for, because you're in business, keep this conversation going. This bill is the best route that we've had in a very long time. And as Governor Edgar told me along the way, keep doing what you're doing. Be disciplined about it. When you have conversations about the bill, we're not asking for the moon, but we are asking for sizable changes, things that arguably should have happened many, many years ago. So again, thank you for the discussion. I appreciate the discussion we've had here this evening.
Those are some of the remarks from Transforming Our Schools, a panel on education funding presented recently in Decatur. You can hear the full broadcast at WUIS.org. For the WUIS Education Desk, I'm Bill Wheelhouse.